Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and I made this myself. Well, not entirely alone. My guest this week is writer-producer-director Ingrid Veninger, who's established herself as more or less the standard-bearer of Canadian independent cinema with features like Only, Modra, I Am a Good Person, I Am a Bad Person, and The Animal Project. Her latest movie, He Hated Pigeons, makes its Toronto premiere at the Bloor Hot Dog Cinema this Sunday, October 18th, with live musical accompaniment. I'll tell you more about it at the end of the episode. Ingrid chose a film I've been expecting someone to bring to the show for a few months now, A Woman Under the Influence, John Cassavetes' landmark 1974 drama starring Jenna Rollins as Mabel Longhetti, a California housewife whose world is slowly falling apart, and Peter Falk as her husband Nick, who is alternately her greatest enabler and her worst enemy. It's an absolutely stunning showcase of two actors, probably at their finest, and a director working at the top of his form. It's arguably the finest expression of Cassavetes' aesthetic and intentions ever put on the screen, and I only say arguably because someone listening is bound to go, no, Love Streams. Okay, I accept your point. But for me, this is the man's masterpiece, and the woman's as well. Ms. Rollins, this one is for you. This is someone else's movie.
I first heard about it when I was working with Peter Mettler, and I'd say the early 90s, we were doing Tectonic Plates, and Mettler just out of the blue said, you should see Cassavetes' work, you'll like it. And it took me about 10 years to see my first Cassavetes film, which was A Woman Under the Influence. I saw it in 2001 in Vancouver with Aubrey Nealon, who's actually a writer on Orphan Black.
In a theater?
Yeah, in a theater. Man. Saw it in the theater, and I was wrecked afterwards. I mean, I just remember going back to his car and sobbing. I just felt, I guess it was a heartbreak, like a kind of overwhelming feeling of feeling that has, I still am kind of unraveling. I mean, I sort of do my work thinking about Cassavetes often, and when I hit an obstacle or a wall, I think, what would Cassavetes do? I mean, that seeing that film made such an impression on me and got under my skin so deep that it inspired me. I mean, it really inspired me, and then I've seen all of his films since.
Yeah, it's my first encounter with Woman. I'd definitely seen Gloria before that, because that was the one that got the most theatrical play, I think. My first encounter with Woman Under the Influence was on a time-coded VHS tape in, I can almost give you the day, in June of 1992, because I was about to be flown out to Los Angeles for a Disney press day, because they'd acquired the Castle Hill package, which is the same five films in the Cassavetes box now from Criterion. So Woman Under the Influence, Opening Night, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Shadows and Faces. They were going to be rolling them out over the course of what they had originally determined would be 6 months. It ended up being 2 years because people didn't buy them that much. But they were rolling out these films on VHS and Laserdisc. And they were doing it by launching first with A Woman Under the Influence. And they had a big event out at the AFI in Los Angeles. And it was Jenna Rollins, Peter Falk, Al Raban, the producer, and Seymour Cassell. The collective, like the surviving Cassavetes Trust, basically. Although Gazzara wasn't there, which was kind of sad. I was sort of hoping I'd meet him. And I had never seen Woman. They sent us a videotape. I watched it, and the next day I got on a plane. And then the day after that, I met these people at the AFI, and interest was so dulled that only four journalists were there, I want to say. There was me. I was repping the Toronto Star's home video column. There was a guy there from the Tower Records music magazine, which had a huge reach in 1992.
Yeah.
And then there was somebody from AP and maybe Reuters, but there were two other wire service guys. Maybe one of them was international, because actually they wouldn't have seated the AP and the Reuters guy at the same table. So what they did was they broke up the four journalists, and we each got two and two journalists. I was paired with a Tower guy, and we got half an hour with Jenna Rollins and Peter Falk, and then half an hour with Al Raban and Seymour Cassell, and we swapped tables. And it was like I was 23, and it was just one of the greatest days.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was fantastic. Falk was, you know, like, he showed up, asked for red wine immediately. It was like 11:30 in the morning, and come on, sweetie, you know you got something somewhere. And they just kept his glass filled, and he was delightful, like an uncle you haven't seen in forever, but just intimate relationship. Like, he is the guy from Wings of Desire, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, yeah.
And Roland's was wonderful, and Cassell was delightful, and Al Raban was great because he was the one who clearly screamed the most throughout all the production of all of these films as the producer to just make something sensible out of everything. And it looks like he won, so he wins now too, just by virtue of these films existing.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I was as starstruck as you get, but it was just this incredible exposure to a type of filmmaking that was already dead in 1992. Like, it simply wasn't happening.
Right.
And then I spent years catching up and watching everything else.
So, and in that half hour, you had your questions. Did it immediately go into process? Like, what was sort of the angle of that half hour?
We talked about all kinds of stuff. I had never seen the film before the day I saw it then in the run up to that thing, and I just had this weird conviction that it was written as a play,
mm-hmm.
and it was, mm-hmm. as it turns out. And,
exactly.
And they, Falk and Roland, said that it was originally designed to be performed over two nights. There would be an act, like, the first half would be before Mabel goes off, and the second would be when she comes back. And they could never figure out, Falk said, they could never figure out a way to stage it that wouldn't alienate people. They couldn't be sure people would come back because there was so much pain and intensity at the end of the first half.
Right.
That it's just like, I don't think I want to know what happens to her.
Right.
Just, like,
it's
it could
too
actually
much.
End with her going away, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Cassavetes was never able to convince a theater to buy into it.
Uh-huh.
And also, I think one of them said there's a question of matinee. How do you handle day shows? Like, do you do half and half? Do you rotate it? How do you get the audience to come back? And
right.
it all came back to the idea that if you make a movie, you're trapping people with it, and they can't leave. Which, of course, you can, but why would you?
Yeah. And also, I'd heard that doing the performance repeatedly was going to be exhausting for Jenna.
Oh, I can't imagine.
That doing that night after night, you know, even for a one-week run or something like that, would just be way too hard. So hence the film, hence the screenplay, which I'm so happy it's a film. I mean, I'm so happy I can rewatch this work. And there's very few films that I've watched and read the script alongside.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that with a woman because we hear so much about it being improvised. And, you know, the word around Cassavetes is there's so much improvisation. Well, there's not.
Yeah.
Have you read the script?
I don't know that I have. I've seen excerpts of it.
I mean, I would encourage everyone to read this particular script. I mean, there's so few camera directions. I mean, there's high angle, there's low angle, mm-hmm. there's close up, but there's, other than that, no direction technically. And then there's no adjectives in terms of how something should be said or how something should be played. And there's almost no exclamation marks, especially on Peter Falk's stuff, on Nick's dialogue. Mm-hmm. No exclamation marks. So it's said that the emotion is improvised, but the dialogue isn't. And when you read the script and watch the film, that's so completely obvious.
That does, and that corroborates something that Falk said, which was that the story he told about being directed by Cassavetes was that he would say during the big spaghetti sequence, like during the big dinner table scene, he said that he would ask Cassavetes, like, how am I playing this? What am I doing exactly? And Cassavetes would take him by the arm and walk him around the set and talk to him. He said he would talk for 5 minutes and then he'd drop me off back at the mark and he'd walk away and say action. And I would realize in the second that I opened my mouth, he didn't tell me anything.
Right.
Like, he talked about everything but the performance.
Right.
So Falk almost at sea, which is exactly what Nick is. But yeah, shaping the performances without actually touching the actor. Like, you hear about the great flaw now of late period Eastwood and Woody Allen is that they don't direct their actors at all. And you can really see that in some films where an actor who doesn't have a strong sense of self just doesn't know what to do. Eastwood's child actors, like they don't even know what to do with their arms in some scenes
right.
in Hereafter or in Gran Torino. The actors are just marooned.
Right.
And Woody Allen you see actors who don't know what to do trying to emulate Alan's cadences sometimes, like that's what he wants.
Yeah.
And then other actors try the different thing and they end up being more defined because they're not giving you the sort of performance that you think that they think that Woody Allen expects.
Yeah.
And with Cassavetes, there isn't even that sense. There's the sense of like an unmoored character instead of an actor who's lost. You never feel that someone is struggling professionally. Like, you don't get the sense of the actor bleeding out of the character. You feel that the character is lost when that happens, but you, like, the naturalism is so instant.
Raw. It's so present. Yeah, and you hear the same thing about the Coen brothers, that they don't really direct their actors. And yet, when you see still behind-the-scenes stills of the making of Cassavetes films, he's acting out the part.
He's, like, the most dynamic person in the
picture. Exactly. He's going, and this. And so he's sort of... There's not a lot of blocking, they say. He doesn't really rehearse. But it seems that maybe before the actors come on set, he's kind of going through how he might imagine it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we know that 20 or 30% of the shots are handheld, mostly by him. He then lets the movement in front of a lens inform the angles.
Yeah.
It's that way of working.
There's a visceral connection between the performance and the camera that... It's like a negative, I'm going to sound incredibly pretentious, but there's a negative space where emotions are just like rushing in to fill that space, and no other director could do it consistently. I still don't really know how he pulled it off, except that he built a company of actors who trusted mm-hmm. him and were trying, like, there are scenes when you get the feeling that Roland is a second away from throwing something at him just to get him out of the way. It's mm-hmm. this really weird presence of the camera.
Mm-hmm. Again, in sort of reading the script and watching the film and looking at the stills and watching the film again, you know, he says, I hate discipline and all, but he's fiercely disciplined. I mean, he's on point, he's on target. And no, he might not give a line reading, or no, he might not direct his actors very much, but he's got a great bullshit detector, and if he sees bullshit, he'll call it, and he'll call it in the middle of a take. He'll say, bullshit, do it again, or he'll direct as they're going. So it's not like he just accepts what's coming out or that he doesn't intervene. He's an active agent in making things happen. I sort of feel like his sets operate, I can imagine this, with not that many, that big a crew. It's everybody's eyes, everybody's focus, concentration, energy is on what's happening in front of the camera. And everybody's working to facilitate that, like in a sort of family dynamic with conflict, with tension, with uncertainty, with fear, with love, with hatred, with trust, with betrayal, with all of it. It's like his whole set is kind of a feeling machine.
Yeah.
Well, and that's such an amazing atmosphere.
And maybe that explains it. Maybe, like, the air is charged somehow with that energy of people. And
yeah.
It's given that so many of his films were scraped together financially, just stapled onto each other, and that he would make a movie to go out and earn and raise the fund. Like, he's in, I guess it was 2-minute warning that he made so he could finish Chinese Bookie, I think.
Oh, is that right?
I think that was the post-production money, or it might have been opening night, but it was all so jumbled up together.
Yeah.
I think it's Chinese Bookie because there are two radically different cuts, and one of them is the result of having more money.
Right, okay.
And he would just go off and do stuff.
Make money, come back, put them in the film, or mortgage the house or whatever, right?
Wells used to do that all the time, but Wells never got finished work out of it. Or, you know, a third of his movies remain just incomplete.
Yeah.
Cassavetes has that incredible focus where even if the movie feels like it's going to fly off the rails or literally off the screen, there's a control to it.
Yeah.
And in the case of A Woman Under the Influence, it is just this incredible... precise focus on those two people, on Nick and Mabel, and watching everything about them come out over the course of, 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, and you hear it just as you were talking, I was thinking about that film Blue Valentine. I was thinking about the story around that film, that, you know, the actors lived together for a year and had a wedding ceremony and then had this and had that in preparation of shooting. Well, 40 years ago, I mean, Cassavetes was... find the location, all the crew paints the house, everybody has a big pot of spaghetti together. It's like camp movie.
Yeah.
Everybody's living the film. It's not separate from life. It is actually life. And that sort of commitment to the process, I think, created this fearlessness we're talking, like, that he's associated with respect to the result.
Yeah.
He truly, and this comes, you know, the freedom of paying for his films, or Peter Falk and him, you know, both contributing the production, the money towards making this film, but that there was truly not a risk of failing, that in fact was a really important part of it. You had to risk failure. You had to, as the actors, had to risk being foolish. They had to risk being wrong. They had to risk being, you know, everything. They had to be fearless. And he, by extension, had to be on the front lines of that and be fearless by putting his money on the front lines. And then when no studio wanted to distribute the film, I guess, was he one of the first?
He was the first ones
to actually make the calls and book the theaters and to self-distribute?
It certainly, I mean, documentaries had done it, but I think he was the first fictional feature filmmaker to do it.
Right.
And again, only somebody who had both feet in the professional industry could pull it off, because he would know what to do.
Yeah.
The other thing that Cassavetes very rarely gets credit for is not breaking down the barriers to distribution, but figuring out how to do it within the existing framework. Like, he used the industry against itself and introduced this virus of independent film into studio pictures. Like, I mean, he directed studio films like A Child Is Waiting, and they're not bad.
Yeah.
But they're not the movies he wants to make.
Yeah.
And then once he starts getting his own momentum going, I mean, he was sort of operating separately while the American film renaissance, like, that's happening. New independent cinema is establishing itself. And on the other side, in L.A., usually, he's doing his thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, yes, Arthur Penn is making Bonnie and Clyde over there, and here we have, you know, like, the sort of the Jack Nicholson, Bob Rafelson activity going on in a different part of Los Angeles or in Malibu, maybe. And Cassavetes is off just doing what he's doing, and it's so different from everything else that it's almost still considered separate, right, from the rest of that revolution that was happening.
Totally. And it's not like it was easy. I mean, everything you've just said translates to me as there were unions. I mean, we know the story of in the first week of shooting a woman, he had AFI union crew members on set. As soon as the crew leader came, they all had to walk. And then, you know, for a little while, they couldn't afford any film. And he was going to roll whether it was film in the camera or not. And then they piecemealed together another crew. And everybody just, like, stepped up their game. People were stepping into roles of sound recordist or camera operator, having to, like, doing it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he empowered people. And yes, he was doing all of this inside of a mentality, like, outside of a mentality, but parallel to, that's impossible, that won't work, there's no point in doing it, you're a fool to spend your own money. Also, actors, mixing professional actors with non-professional actors. I mean, I don't know where SAG sort of fell on that, but obviously he was a professional actor and he'd acted in his own films, and Jenna was a professional actor, and then you have all these non-professional actors. And today, I mean, I can speak from my own experience, I did a TV show, and there's so many rules around what you can do and can't do. So, for example, I was playing a character that was giving this rousing speech to strike, and in the room were 10 or 15 extras. And so I was calling to them, like, what do you say? Are you in? Are you out? Where do you stand? And none of them could speak.
Right.
Because
right.
if they spoke, they would be upgraded from background to actor, and that would cost the production more money. So then the whole thing was completely unrealistic.
Yeah.
I mean, they couldn't respond. They actually had to sit there silently. And I thought, watching A Woman again, you see Peter Falk throwing out things to the doctor, like, are you having a good time? And he goes, right on, absolutely. Everybody coming into the house for the party, leaving the house, is ad-libbing all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Professional, non-professional, doesn't matter. Like, could you imagine Cassavetes even considering, like, oh, those five people can't speak. You can't speak to those. Like, that would never happen.
I'm trying to figure out how you'd even solve that now. I guess you shoot the back of their heads and loop something in later. Does that count?
I mean, look.
And are there different rules for improvisation now? Is there a way around it? Because it's weird. And we're only just now starting to see filmmakers, like Judd Apatow embraces the idea that someone else can just talk in the middle of a big complex scene, that the bystander becomes part of it. But that's because he made a movie that made $100 million and now he's allowed to take those risks. Or because digital allows you to shoot forever and not waste film. Like, you're not burning money the way you used to. And all of Cassavetes' films were shot on film. Like, I mean, 16 or 35, it's still expensive.
Yeah, and he says something like, you know, he'd shoot a lot of takes, 12, 14 takes. I think A Woman was shot over 5 weeks. The budget was, I think, $800,000. John put in three and Peter Falk put in five. And I read somewhere they shot a million feet of film.
I wouldn't be surprised.
That's crazy. And so, yeah, he liked to shoot. So, yes, we don't have, with the technology we have now, we can shoot a lot and it's more economical. But, and we can make amazingly, you know, great looking films for a relatively low budget. But he was, I just think he operated in a way that he understood the rules. Obviously, he worked on huge pictures. But if the rules weren't going to serve what he wanted to make, forget the rules.
Right.
And if... It because the films, the need to make the films was bigger than all that. It was so then if no one was going to come see it or if he couldn't sell it, he would do it himself. He would play it in his own theater downstairs from his apartment. He would, by whatever means necessary, kind of, these films had to be. I mean, I read one time where he said all the funding fell through for some film and he promised everyone they were going to start shooting on this date and he basically was going to start shooting whether there was film in the camera or not. He was going to start shooting. So that kind of fire and determination is, I mean, it's still contagious.
Yeah. I mean, you're basically seeing the, like, it's the realization, it's the concrete example of something like the Actors Lab where you are just watching. If it didn't work, it would be acting exercises.
Right.
It would be, and they would be interminable. Because it would just be people going bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, at least A Woman Under the Influence could play that way. Certainly, if there wasn't the sense of a controlling vision behind it, Rowlands is fantastic. But you know, you've seen what can happen when actors trust their directors and the directors don't know what to do. You get really histrionic performances or really small, like kind of bottled up things that don't play as minimalism because they're not framed properly. Then the world around them isn't right, and what Cassavetes managed to do, like, every single time, is build the world that you believe.
Yeah.
And then find a context for these performances.
Exactly.
Obviously, there's no one else who could have done what Rowlands does.
Yeah.
Because no one else would have trusted Cassavetes as much, I suspect.
Yeah.
But Falk is great, too.
Oh, he's so good. And I mean, that... I won't say truth. I mean, Meisner says acting is... truth under imaginary circumstances. But I think for Cassavetes, it was being real, because truth is kind of heady. Being real, feeling real, because it was so emotional. Feeling real under imaginary circumstances. And he set up those circumstances.
Yeah.
From the paint on the walls to every little piece of, every trinket on every counter to the big pot of spaghetti. All the details are meticulously thought through. And so the imaginary circumstances and the environment and the world is completely controlled. And the dialogue is written. And so inside of that, he trusts his actors so much that when Jenna Rowlands does that, which came out of her apparently, spontaneously out of her when she did a talk at TIFF Bell Lightbox a couple of years ago, someone said, was that in the script? Did he direct that physicality or did that come out of you? She said, no, it just came out of me, out of an impulse, and he liked it. For him, that felt authentic and true and real. Now, to another director, that might have been too much.
Yeah.
But for Cassavetes, it almost seemed like no physicality that came out of an impulse that was born out of the actor playing that character who now knows the character inside and out could be false. He would trust that. And I think that takes big courage because that's risky from the actor's stand, but also from the director's stand to accept it, embrace it, build on it, because it's physical and it's big. The emotions are big. When an actor goes from crying to laughing to screaming, a lot of directors would go,
pick one,
settle
pick
down.
Two, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Dial it back.
Exactly. But he wasn't afraid of the bigness of emotion or the contradictions or all of those crazy fluctuations. He was like yes to that.
Yeah, Danny Boyle told me once in an interview that he makes specimens of his characters, that he creates an atmosphere where he picks them apart and dissects them 127 hours was the example he used. He's like, you're trapped with this character and I'm trapping us all there to see what happens. Cassavetes kind of worked the same way in that he would establish an environment and let things grow. But rather than dissection, I think he was more like the guy who puts the glass bowl over the bread to see if penicillin comes out. Like, he would just see what evolved.
Exactly. And he was curious. It was like child's play, or like, and also like, how far can this go?
Yeah. Which is what I think justifies or enables what happens in A Woman Under the Influence, is that no one is cruel. People are unthinkingly cruel, and Nick certainly, he's not a man who understands his wife. But because of that sort of trapped in amber aspect of the film, of the storytelling, you get the sense that it really is about that moment. It's about sort of the unfocused sexism, the dismissiveness of Mabel's problems, the idea that, oh, I'll come home with 30 guys from the office, from the construction crew or whoever I bring home, and we're all going to sit down and it's no problem for her to make food for everybody. And to just heap things on her in a kind of like small townish mentality. So much of that stuff is rooted in these characters, but we see it come out in the weirdest, smallest ways, like Mabel's little gesture, or like the way Nick kind of doesn't look her in the eye for half the time they're together, just because, well, that would be too much attention at this moment. He has to perform for the guys.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much going on that we're always privy to.
Yeah.
And that's just, I think of that as something that Cassavetes can do, or John Sayles sort of picked up that tag. And even though they're completely different filmmakers, Sayles is much more of a formalist.
Yeah.
The observation of emotional, like, it's emotional authenticity, for lack of a better word, but it's also stuff that these guys have thought about, not just the directors, but the actors. They've been steeped in this, in these individuals. They're not playing a role. They're being a person.
Exactly. And I think, I can't help but watch the film, and, you know, and this has been written about too, Kent Jones wrote about Jenna Rowland's character, Mabel, is Cassavetes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I keep thinking of, okay, so she's representing the filmmaker that is not conforming to the normal codes of behavior. No, I'm not. Because she can be funny, she can be sad, she can be angry. She's being present and real and authentic in the moment. And that is somehow very difficult to accept, because people, the industry, the studio, like Nick, wants to put people in boxes. They just want them to be one thing and be that thing consistently.
Yeah.
And Mabel can't do that. She's open to all things. And so she's changing all the time. And that feels like that so much represents Cassavetes to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, given that he was a leading, like a proper leading man, and I would like to say Polanski was the first person to sort of nudge him out of that with Rosemary's Baby, but he'd already been doing it on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of playing with his image, pushing back against the idea that he was tall and strikingly handsome and intense. But that's not an easy role for someone who has ambition to play. You go to the blander side of that and you get someone like John Gavin, who kind of looked like Cassavetes. I'm always struck in Ben Hur, it's just like, wow, if Cassavetes had played Masala, that would have been an incredibly different film.
Yeah.
But you get the sense with Cassavetes' career as an actor, towards like the second movement, stuff like The Fury or even 2 Minute Warning, he's not giving the studio what they want. He's giving the director what they want.
Yeah.
He's working with people who understand him.
Yeah.
But he's just refusing to play a straight line.
Yeah.
And it, because in his films, the straight line had absolutely held no interest for him.
Yeah. And how much do you think that hurt his career as an actor? Do you think he might have gone, you know, bigger, stronger, faster if he was a little more obedient and played more of those straight roles?
He probably would have, but it wouldn't have been any fun.
Like
it wouldn't have been any fun for him, I suspect. If he'd been chasing a normal career, he would never have signed on to an Italian gangster picture in the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
And this gives him, like, Machine Gun McCain gives him everything. It gives him the building blocks of the rest of his career. It's not a great movie. It's not even particularly memorable, except for its historical significance.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
67 or 68, 67. I think.
Yeah, and then it's interesting to think of Peter Falk was doing Columbo at the time a woman. So again, you can way to go for Peter Falk too to play this role. I mean, they met here, so Husbands was done
70, I think.
Right, so they acted together, they were buddies, and we hear the stories about Peter Falk really not knowing what Cassavetes was on about and then getting more and more with the program and trusting him more and more and then just unleashed himself into a woman. But he was doing Columbo at the same time. I mean, just imagine his people going, are you sure about this?
Yeah, well, there's actually an episode of Columbo with the two of them where Cassavetes is the bad guy, and it's just one of those things where you see that they are just having the best time making a completely forgettable piece of product that will be aired and forgotten. And they know that there's better stuff, that this is what you do to make people interested in the movie you really want to make, the thing you really care about.
Yeah.
And I think both Falk and Cassavetes were experts at using the system and sort of bending it to their will. Even though, in the case of Cassavetes, it meant more often than not he would take a role so he could get something financed, and then that would mean showing up in something that wasn't necessarily going to be a piece of his canon, like an immortal piece of work.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think about if Indiegogo or Kickstarter was around, because he was doing that kind of thing 40 years ago. He was on a radio show and he was pitching his projects and taking donations or whatever. He would have loved Indiegogo, and also just he was so ahead of his time, you know?
Yeah.
He was just in the way of making, in the way of distributing, and he said also that, and I don't know how much this is really true, but that the film wasn't the thing. The process was the thing. The process, the making, was the living itself. And the film was sort of the remnant of the experience. It was kind of like the tracks left behind. It was just the series of choices everyone made to get to a thing.
Right.
But it was just the residue of the experience. And so he wasn't attached to that, although I think that he did watch the films and would look down at the people coming into the theater and the people leaving halfway through and going, I can't stand this, and then turning around and going back in. So I think he was very interested in audience, and he was very interested in reaction. But in terms of studying the film or getting precious in any way around the film, that wasn't his gig, you know? And I think as filmmakers, I mean, it's certainly something that I'm trying to practice is, you know, we control everything from the words we put on the page to where the camera is and casting the actors and putting the actors in a certain emotional place, and then every frame of the edit, and then every burp or breath or, you know, bird flying by or car panning from left to right. We control everything so much, and you can, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm as brave as Cassavetes, although that's my, like, he's sort of my...
It's your aspirational goal.
Film goal, filmmaking kind of goal, yeah. I'm sort of more in the middle, but I do think that we sort of put the controllers on a pedestal and think, oh, they've controlled every little aspect of this. They're masters. And I think, no, it's much easier to just tell people what to do, like you're conducting an orchestra, versus being a jazz leader and creating a framework where people can shine and take a solo and take it another direction and really risk maybe making, like, having that night be a disastrous, you know, live performance. But conducting in a different way, conducting in his way, is something I really aspire to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the obvious comparison then, just for in terms of a contemporary, is Robert Altman.
Yeah.
Who
for sure
would similarly create unstructured spaces.
Yeah.
And mic everybody and then figure out what to use later and where he was zooming, but not tell the actors.
Right.
But that, like, this is going to sound dismissive, but that's sort of a pothead kind of approach to cinema or storytelling. Like, you just, like, whatever, we'll figure it out. I mean, there's more control than there seems to be, but just in the idea of following along a big tapestry, whereas I mean, everything is happening, but it's always kind of calm,
right?
Or it's absolute chaos. With Cassavetes, there's an urgency that drives everything. He's
totally
really interested in two people together at any given moment.
Totally, totally. And I don't think there was anything calm about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like you told a story about Peter Falk and John walking around the table with him around the spaghetti scene. There's a similar story with Jenna Rollins when I think it was after she was in the bathroom and she's standing up on the couch. And she was lost. She didn't know where her character was. She was completely lost and didn't know what to do, and Cassavetes did not help her. And she was saying, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to take a knife and stab it through your heart. And it was personal.
Yeah.
This is personal war. It's the line between life and art is very, very, very blurry. These are real emotions. This is real love-hate stuff. And he just would let her go through that, and then something amazing is born out of that turmoil. But certainly he was, let's go into the pit of turmoil.
Yeah, and they trusted him. They followed him in. Like, those actors are giving it to him.
Well, he demanded that. I think that if people weren't all in, no fakery, no going through the motions, not about acting, it's about really feeling, not about manufacturing. He would weed out the phonies or weed out the people that were doing it for some ulterior motive, like, working on a Cassavetes film will help me get here. That's a good thing on my resume. This will be a good thing on my reel. Those people I don't think would last a day. Yeah. Or someone on their phone. Can you imagine if there were cell phones and people were texting on his set? No way.
I mean, unless you set the movie in that world, which would seem to be something he would do. Like, he'd adapt to whatever he wanted to, whatever story he wanted to tell, he would find a way to fold the activity into it.
Yes, but no crew could be texting, but, like, in a way of that was taking them out of what was happening in the moment.
So, I mean, how do you, when you're shooting, like, you have a fairly, you've made films with a fairly loose structure and kind of open concept, as it were, to what's happening in the frame. How do you manage to keep everyone focused? I mean, when you do this, like, do you have some sort of like, collective agreement with people as they come in that they'll turn their phones off and give you their full attention, or does that just naturally happen?
Yeah, no, I mean, I really do sort of enforce that. In fact, I'd like to say no cell phones whatsoever, but on the Animal Project, for example, that the leap of faith that I needed from the actors before I could even start writing the script, where I cast the actors before there was an idea for a movie and they had to commit to a 3-month shoot, that was sort of the first step of, I hadn't worked with these actors outside of my son, Jacob. I'd seen some of their work. I hadn't seen others. So I was taking a leap of faith and promising them roles. They were taking a leap of faith. They were going to be given a script like a month before shooting, but they didn't have any idea what roles they were going to play. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing, while we're shooting, my crews are small. So when someone is distracted or really not in the game, everybody feels it. My crew is 2-3 people tops, so no cell phones, no talking. I mean, ideally I would be like, no talk, and Cassavetes was like this too apparently, no talking about last night or what you're gonna do later or where we're gonna go drinking or, you know, the movie you just saw last week, none of that.
Right.
We are creating a world, and when you show up, you're in that world 1000%.
So it's an immersive experience from the start.
Yeah. And actually, the Animal Project kind of messed me up, because it was the first time I made a film in Toronto where people were actually going home to their real lives.
Okay.
Right? And actors were telling me, like, they were auditioning for this and that, and they were starting to think about their next projects coming up after. Whereas all of my previous films and my latest film, He Hated Pigeons, have all been shot elsewhere. So there was that immersive kind of camp experience where we're waking up together eating breakfast. We're shooting together. When we're going from one location to another, we're talking about what we're about to do. We're eating dinner together. We're partying together. So you're with everybody 24 hours a day, and family and sort of real life is far away.
Right. Almost abstracted.
Yeah. I love that. In fact, it's my preferred way of making films, actually, very, very, very much so.
So building your own cult and taking it with you.
Yeah, exactly. Building my own cult. Yeah. Everybody has to be a part of the cult. Leave your cell phones at home. Leave your family and friends. Their family and friends sort of fall away for that, you know, specific period of time, 6 weeks or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's full on. It's a full on immersive game.
So that's the question I ask of everybody is, how do you, you know, have you incorporated any lesson from this film? Is there any part of this that influences your aesthetic? But we're already well into that. There's a lot of this that you've taken. Is there, like, with working with actors, are you similar about that strategy? Do you withhold? Do you keep people from
knowing what you want? I don't think I'm quite so manipulative in that way, but I will say that I change things. I mean, the process is an evolutionary one, and the writing is emergent, so they are given a script, and that is a map. And I do say this is a springboard. This is the beginning. It's like we're going on a trip, and we're thinking we're going to the cathedral, and we have the map to get there. But, you know, a block into it, we see an incredible little cobblestone side street right. that's leading who knows where, and that's where I want to go. And I explain this, and I say that's what's going to happen, and everybody goes, yeah, yeah, we want to take risks. That's what we want. But as soon as they start deviating away from the path to the cathedral, people panic. Because even my daughter on Modra, you know, when I radically changed the ending, there was a script. Because actors start to build their character toward
right.
what they read. There's no way that the idea of the script doesn't kind of distill the choices, you know, and sometimes a good way, but I think oftentimes, and it's more limiting. So they're going towards, let's say, an ending where Lena and Leko and Modra decide they are in love, and they decide that they want to keep traveling from Slovakia to the Czech Republic. They want to go to Prague, and the last shot is them getting on a train as an elderly couple get off the train, and the doors close, and the train goes off.
That's sweet.
Right? That was the scripted ending.
Yeah.
And then I was, you know, three quarters of the way through the shoot, and I thought, this is utter bullshit. These characters are 17. That's not the way it's going to go. If they manage to sort of have some kind of friendship, but like a true friendship, a meaningful friendship, where they don't fit. I mean, anyone watching this movie can clearly see they don't fit together mm-hmm. as lifers. So maybe what can come out of this is they might have a friendship where they go to each other's weddings and they whatever. So literally 2 days before we were to get on a plane and come back home, I told my actors that the ending of the script was bullshit, and here are the pages for the new ending, and you guys are going to be on this merry-go-round, and you're going to talk about maybe going to each other's weddings. And everybody was just like, what are you doing? But you have to, Cassavetes does inspire me in that, and there were a few moments where even, you know, Alexander Gamal and Modra said, this is a Cassavetes moment, right? Like when we would be locked out of a location, I would have to immediately and spontaneously come up with a new way to shoot the scene, which was with the magician in the square where he's juggling with these fire lights.
Oh, yeah.
And he meets Lena, and the lights we had were from the square in this village of Modra. That was supposed to be in a bar that we got shut out of, and then we were walking, where can we shoot this at night where there's enough exposure? And that was the only place in the village. So that reinvention and the limitations and the obstacles causing you to sort of create and push yourself, even when people think maybe you're making the wrong choice, but you're trusting something that's bigger than the script, that's bigger than your idea of the film, because now the movie is kind of taking you on the ride.
Yeah.
And you have to hold on. And there's it can be terrifying, and you just have to hold on.
Yeah. It amazes me how many filmmakers just end up saying that, like, the movie wanted things.
Totally.
That art takes over.
Totally.
And that you can't plan, like, the script is handy.
Yes.
God knows it helps.
You can go back to it.
Yeah.
It's always
there. You can always
there.
Tell when people don't have one. That's
right.
What's incredible. That reads through. It's the lack of a foundation always comes through, unless the point of the film is improvisation. And even then, people, like Spinal Tap is a great example of everybody knows what they're doing, even if they don't have it written down. Like, they
right.
just, they know where they're going.
Right.
And then you see something else where, oh, we were shooting Transformers 3, and yeah, there needed to be a scene where Shia LaBeouf gets humped by a robot. Nah, and we'll figure that out. And you can feel that, yep, that's exactly how this scene happened. They just
right.
needed to shoot something that day.
Right.
I'm sorry, Michael Bay, but you know what you did. And with the Cassavetes work, there is always that guiding intelligence and that confidence that you're going to get somewhere.
Yes.
And it happens, yeah, in Modra, I like the ending that you just described, but I know that it's wrong. I've seen the way the movie was supposed to end because that's how it ended.
Yes.
You've sort of retroactively undermined your argument.
Yeah. And also, I think that, you know, the script, when you're saying, what do I take away, I think we get, look, Cassavetes talks about the process being a true adventure, like a series of making discoveries. And I feel like now scripts are being read by people that we're supposed to say everything in the script, from the camera angles to how the characters are picking up a glass to how they're walking across the room. Whereas when you read A Woman Under the Influence, there aren't those descriptions because he's writing a script for the people that are going to be making the film.
Right.
And that's the way I write. No one outside of my actors and my crew reads my scripts. So that's incredibly liberating that because I pretty much fund my own films, I'm writing my scripts to be made, to be produced, not to be, I don't know, evaluated as a short story or novel might be evaluated, where everyone has to see everything that might be on the screen.
Right.
It's a completely different document. So I have never really written a script for others to read and evaluate that way, to give me funding or not give me funding. And so that is something I would love to be able to still write scripts my way and get money for them.
Right. I think that's why scripts are written like that now. It's because it's to head off notes from executives who are going to say, well, you don't say what kind of music is playing. And I know that, you know, Franz Ferdinand is really hot right now.
Right.
One of my favorite examples of a written screenplay, a properly written, like fully realized script, is Bruce Robinson's script for Widdle and I, where early on there's a stage direction that says the music will continue until I tell it to stop. And it's just like, yep, you know what you're doing. Like, right. This is the movie in your head, and you're right. Translating it immediately to the page. But now everything has to be written for... Every character has to possibly, you know, the female lead could be Sandra Bullock, could be Reese Witherspoon. They're incredibly different, but it depends on who wants it that day. And what executives see it, and what producers see it, and which director might take it. So I think now what we're seeing is this desperation to lay out every single piece of it, and that it doesn't kill things. In the screenplays that I have read, sometimes it's possible to build up real drama and entertain people, but it also does say, I am unconvinced that you will see what I'm trying to do unless I give it to you on every level. And what you're doing is what Cassavetes did with his scripts, and what you're doing is saying, this is what I'm going to do, and you figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Like, you're telling people that you're inviting them to fill it in. You're collaborating.
And I'm actually... I mean, like, he walked his talk to say, this is a liftoff. This is a springboard into the movie. I don't want to know exactly what I'm going to make. I don't want to know when he's asked who the film is for. It's for people. Yes. Is it for women or men in a certain, like, age bracket? No, it's for people. So to have everything answered in the script, I think is very limiting. And maybe it's because, you know, my big influence is Peter Mettler, who works in documentary, and having worked with him for 20 years, and he's very process-oriented, where he really does go out and seek and find. For me, doing that in narrative and the fiction work is really important, because I can, even from my limited experience on five features that I've directed, see how a script really does trap the potential of kind of a living, breathing, alive discovery, a process of discovery.
Yeah. Well, there are scripts that tell you what's going to happen, and there are scripts that tell you what is going to be set up.
Yeah.
Like what you're establishing. It's inquiry versus lecture.
Exactly. And if you deviate from that thing that you've set up, then people just roll their eyes and go, oh, the director doesn't know what they're doing now, because they're deviating. People don't like deviation. They see that as a failure or a flaw. Whereas I love what Cassavetes sort of, he embraces there's no failure, first of all, but those flaws you hear about as composer, sound recordist, mixer, talking about wanting to polish off the music, for example, in a woman. And Cassavetes used all the scratch track music. He loved that unpolished, doesn't want everything shiny and new.
Yeah, I can't imagine a John Cassavetes film with proper production values. That's
no,
just
I mean,
not
the out
what
of focus
about.
Is part of it, and these crazy jump cuts and the lack of continuity.
Oh,
and
grain, just film, fantastic. Like just from the lighting choices. Like
exactly.
The thing that I was so happy to see preserved on the, I mean, and of course it would be, because Criterion would never, ever use too much noise reduction or deface a film. But they look like movies made by one person.
Right.
Like there's a guy with a camera, and he maybe didn't get the lighting kit that he wanted that day, but he's doing something with it.
Right.
And there's always a reason for the limitations that he imposed on himself. And the transfer of the DVD and the Blu-ray honor that. I mean, I think it's hysterical that these things are available in high definition, because they were never meant to be seen with this level of clarity. But that's what they, like, that's perfect. It's what it looked like to walk in and watch a 16mm print 3 years after it was first released and experience it that way. Because I think that's what Cassavetes wanted. Like, you just find the movie when you find it.
Totally.
Like, it doesn't matter that, I mean, I was a kid when it was released. I was like, 6 maybe in 1974, and I didn't find it until I was in my early 20s, but I think that's when you're supposed to find it, and it would look, and it looked right then. It was waiting for me.
Yeah, what a beautiful way to say it. Yeah, wait, Cassavetes films wait for you, and then they just like turn your life upside down. Yeah.
And they're not dated. Like, it's weird. They're not dated because they should be. They should be dated as hell. They should. The clothes should be triggers. The cars. And somehow you just get the sense that you're dropping into a specific moment, like a window in time has been opened for you, and this is what you're seeing. Totally. And it's all artificial. It's constructed and acted and performed and edited. But he feels like his films feel like life, like you're stumbling into it. And it's just so, it's so thrilling. It's so thrilling that he got it right every time, too, that his movies always managed to have some element of, like, vitality.
Yeah.
These experiments that he made.
Yeah. And even, like, I'm thinking technically in that scene in the stairwell where Peter Falk, Nick grabs Mabel after she's come home and near the end of the film, and he wants her back. He's just like, just be you. Be normal. Be you. Be you. Do you want me to be funny? Do you want me to be sad? Do you want me to be sexy? Do you want me to be... And he starts going, Baba. Give me Baba. And they're in the stairwell and they're completely dark. You can just see a little bit of their silhouettes. Yeah. And she can't say Baba. And he starts screaming at her, give me a Baba. And you know that's Cassavetes, you know, shooting that. And I don't know how many times they did it, but today, if some studio was looking at those rushes, they'd say, well, that can't be in the final film. You can't even see them. But you're not supposed to. I mean, it's perfect that they're there in the dark. And then he, you know, she steps back into the light and then he sort of he pulls her back into the light.
Yeah.
All of those things, darkness inside of light, insanity inside of sanity, all of those things live so in such a charged and timeless way in this film. And like Sean Penn said, you know, in A Constant Forge, the documentary on the Criterion thing, he said, if you're an actor, watching Cassavetes films is the best acting school you're ever going to get. That's for sure.
It feels incredibly intimidating to me. I'm not an actor, so I don't have that that sense of, like, I see that and think, I don't know that I'm even capable of letting that kind of thing out of me in my own life, let alone in front of an audience. I don't know that I have that level of depth or emotional reality. And I don't feel like less of a person for it. I just, like, that's one of those things where it's like okay, that is not my gig. I admire the hell out of people who do it.
Yeah.
But it looks exhausting and wrenching and painful. And I mean, that's what art is. Like, it makes art. It doesn't make television.
Yeah.
But I'm in awe of people who could pull that out of other human beings and then have them still want to be his friend at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think a lot of actors left the... during the making, a lot of actors would hate him and say, I am never working with him again. And then they would see the final result and say, give me more Cassavetes.
Yeah.
And I think it also made a difference that he was on the front lines. He put himself out as an actor as well. I mean, he was taking all kinds of risks and husbands, physical risks.
Oh,
and that scene with the blonde is amazing, you know, where they're tossing and turning all over each other. But he was on the front lines. So it made actors... it's like, you're walking your talk, man. You're asking me to be incredibly vulnerable and trust you, and you demand that of yourself. He's on the front lines of it, and I think that starts to help build a trust.
Yeah, as a woman who makes movies, as a woman director and producer, writer, and an actor yourself, how do you feel about watching that, looking into that window of 1970s chauvinism, really? Because it's not. It's not intentional, but there's something really weird, and I can't conceive of people living that way with one another. But it played awkwardly for me in the 90s. It plays awkwardly for me now. It's necessary to who Nick and Mabel are. But how do you feel watching that? I mean, is it something that you can even identify with, the kind of the gender dynamic and sexual relationships that are going on?
Well, I mean, he's just such a desperate man. He's such a helpless, hopeless man making wrong choices all the time. And he made a huge, huge mistake. And he has to live with the guilt of that forever. I mean, she's imagination in motion. And she is just so present and raw. And he's so incredibly flawed. And I have sympathy. I mean, I hate him and I love her, but I kind of love him too. And they're both nuts. Yeah. You know, they're both completely nuts. And if anything, reading the script, you see how much was taken out of the script, because at the end of the film, they're silent and life kind of goes on. And he has to live with his choices. And she's going to have to live with knowing that she can't be just a normal, appropriately behaved woman. She can't do that. Before going into the institution or after coming out of the institution. She can't do that. And he ultimately doesn't want that, but he got so messed up by what his wife should be like and the way people are supposed to act and what happiness looks like and what normal life should be like. He got trapped. And then at the end, you know, in the script, they say we're both crazy. Like, how can I love you and hate you so much in equal measure? Because I'm crazy and you're crazy, and well, just we're gonna keep stumbling through, you know, and it's completely not resolved. But him taking the kids to the beach and like dragging them here and there and giving them beer, which was real beer, by the way, you know, which is like, and the brand of the beer is completely visible, right. And all of that stuff, which if you needed to get, you know, insurance, probably you wouldn't be able to get. But Cassavetti's like, yes, this is real beer, and young kids are drinking it. I mean, there's so many things, there's so many things that he's challenging in that film. Little Maria running around naked, his mother playing the mother, Nick's mother, I mean, she's fantastic. So she's also, in terms of, look at her role in that whole dynamic. I mean, she's completely got her son's back and is calling Mabel crazy and is probably a big factor of her being put in the institution. In fact, if the mother wasn't there, if that woman wasn't there, I don't know if Mabel would have ended up going into the institution.
Yeah, she does provide, she's doing a lot of nudging.
A lot of nudging, yeah. And Nick is so, he can't seem to make a decision for himself, or he makes the wrong choices. So, I mean, that mother is the evil one, you know? Nick is kind of just a sad sack, a sad sorry sack.
Yeah.
And Mabel is a goddess.
Yeah, she is. I mean, you cannot give Jenna Rollins enough credit for that performance. She was great in pretty much everything. Like the 70s were a magnificent time for her, and the 80s were pretty good too. But with Cassavetes especially, she has a sort of just a vitality, a power to her performances, a sort of weary strength that becomes brittle and terrifying. And yeah, I can't imagine her doing this on stage night after night after night.
That would be devastating.
She'd have lost weight. She'd have lost her balance. I mean, she would have hurt herself, I think, very quickly.
Yeah.
But it's one of those amazing, how did she not win every award kind of
and
performances.
And she was nominated, right? Which is already Oscar, a huge thing that Cassavetes was nominated for Best Director and she was nominated for Best Actor when this film was made so outside the rules and so far on the fringe that it managed to get that nod is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And she did her own makeup. She did her own wardrobe. I mean, the thing is, like, okay, yes, the performance, and yes, the whole atmosphere, and yes, the risk-taking and all of that, but this is a husband and wife that are at the end of the day, you know, he's just going down into the edit room, which is in the same house, and editing all night long. Like, how does that... I mean, he lived and breathed the filmmaking, but, like, when do they actually make love? Like, how did those kids happen?
Yeah.
I think all of that.
It's one of those things where you have to believe that relationship was either more supportive than any other relationship in human history.
Right.
Because he's putting himself through hell to make the movie, and she's putting herself through hell for him to make his movie.
Yes.
But also because I'm sure she knows what kind of performance she's giving him.
Well, and also she's the one that wanted to do the play, right? So I think this was a role she brought to him and said, I want to play this woman, this portrait of a contemporary woman. And he couldn't get funding because the studios were saying, we don't want to see some crazy dame on screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they did it himself. But I felt like he, as a husband, as a filmmaker, wanted to see her play this role that she wanted to play.
Yeah, I mean, it is an incredible gift to her.
Right.
That this film exists, that the final piece of art exists. But I just, you know, you kind of, I have this wonderful little image of them just fighting over who gets more time in the bathroom that day. And like, because you have to manage the rest of your lives.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't easy. I'm sure it wasn't easy.
And in the end, they both get Oscar nominations for it. As you said, Hollywood recognized a non-studio picture. And this was the year, it was 1974, it was the year that Godfather 2 won almost everything.
Uh-huh.
Jenna Rollins lost to Ellen Burstyn in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which, you know, hard to say anything against that. It's a great performance. Yeah. She was also up against Valerie Perrine in Lenny, with really more of a supporting role. Faye Dunaway in Chinatown, which, again, one of those performances you can't say anything about. Diane Carroll in Claudine, which I had never seen. And Cassavetes was up against, oh my God, this might have been the best line. He lost to Coppola for Godfather 2. Right. Also nominated.
And they were buddies.
Year.
Were they buddies? I don't know if Coppola. I think Scorsese and Cassavetes were really good.
I can see buddies. That. They kind of came out of the same handheld intensity thing.
Yeah.
But also nominated that year were Fosse for Lenny, Truffaut for Day for Night, and Polanski for Chinatown. So, you know, if you're going to lose, it's a good year to lose.
Wow.
It's good company.
Yeah.
But wow.
And he pretty much died making... Was Love Streams his last film? And that he was making as he was sick? And
I want to say... his last movie was called Big Trouble, which he more or less disowned. He finished it, but he wasn't happy with it.
Right. But the last one of his, and that he was in, also Love Streams, but that he was a lifer, man. And as a woman... I mean, there are some lifers as a woman, and it's, you know, it's a tricky juggle, balancing act... Because, you know, I'm a mother and I've been in a relationship for 25 years and my films completely consume me. And so when I start one, everybody is affected, you know, as I'm sure everyone in Cassavetes' life was affected.
Sure, yeah.
But you just, you know, he didn't wait for permission to make the films. He made them when he absolutely felt he needed to. There was an urgency. There was an immediacy that it had to happen now. The stakes were high. He put his money on the line. And he was a lifer making films to his last days on the planet.
Yeah.
That's the way I want to be. That's the way I want to be.
It's not a bad goal.
Yeah.
You know, just keep doing the thing that you love the most.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember also him saying that it was the frustrating thing for him was that his body just didn't have the same energy. I mean, he was getting older and he wasn't well. And so the frustration of just being limited by that, like, give me every limitation, money, not enough money, not enough time, a crew of two, you know, a few actors being blocked out of this, having the rain when I want snow, having the snow when I want sun, all of those things, no problem. But when your body can't go the distance or do those marathon days anymore, that's gotta be...
Yeah.
That's so hard, you know, because he wasn't one to sort of be directing out of a chair passively.
Yeah, a lot of
filmmakers... He was on his feet.
You can feel the energy running down. I think of John Huston making The Dead with an oxygen tank strapped to him. And that's a film that's an elegy, and that's a film that works.
Right.
But it's one of the few cases where faltering health contributes to your understanding of the material.
Amazing.
Cassavetes' last movie was not that, unfortunately. But it's just as well that, you know, he wasn't happy with it, because that's okay, because we don't have to be happy with it either.
Yeah.
He was a guy who lived decades on his own terms as an artist, and this is the legacy, that we have fantastic work. I really hope that at some point, at like 2 a.m. when he slumped over the moviola, Jenna Rollins can bring him soup or something.
I think that's what happened.
That's the picture I have in my head.
That's exactly the picture I have, and that she's there, sort of like in a you know, a swivel chair, going around and around. They're talking about, you know, what time they have to wake up, like sort of around. Everything's all kind of blurred together. So sort of partly about the film, but also maybe who's going to pick up the kids, or what her mom is doing, or what his mom is doing, and just the juggle of life and art rolling all together. But that they had each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, right? And that she had his back. And I remember her, she'd said this sort of in an interview also, that I guess for Gloria, she just said, we can't mortgage the house again. We just can't mortgage the house again. Go and get funding for this one, John, please. Yeah. You know?
And it wasn't his only studio picture as a director, but I think it was the only one from the late period that was.
Right.
And it's not as, like, the compromises are there. You can sort of feel it. It's one of those things where they were right. It was just, you know, it was going to be a genre picture, and they made the movie they wanted to make. But that's what happens when you don't have 100% control. You have 90%, and it shaves a point off here and there. You can sort of feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the other hand, Jenna Rollins kicked a lot of ass.
Oh, she sure did.
My thanks to Ingrid Veninger, whose new film He Hated Pigeons will have its Toronto premiere this Sunday, October 18th, at the Bloor Hot Duck Cinema. Show starts at 3 p.m., admission is pay what you can, and musical accompaniment will be live. So if you're in town, please do check it out. You can find Ingrid on Twitter at punkfilmsnow, which is all one word, and you can find her earlier movies, Only, Modra, and The Animal Project, for sale or rental on iTunes Canada. In Canada, you can also rent Modra on Google Play. In the US, Only is streaming on Amazon Video. But you can order the DVDs from Amazon Canada. Don't tell anyone I told you that. A Woman Under the Influence is available on Blu-ray and DVD in Criterion's outstanding John Cassavetes 5 Films boxed set. It's also available as an individual Criterion DVD, but come on, get the box. You can also rent or buy it on iTunes in the US, and it's streaming on Hulu and Fandor there as well. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, please be as honest as possible. Thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.